I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
Listen to them, children of the night. What music they make.
Trick or treat, kids. It's a special bonus edition of Parallax Views. We dug into the cobwebbed crypts of Parallax Views archives to dust off a previously unpublished conversation for you this Halloween season. We're going to be talking about the life and times of a horror movie icon, namely Dracula himself, Bela Lugosi. He's been immortalized in the pop art of Andy Warhol, was the subject of a hit single by the legendary goth rock band Bauhaus, and was famously portrayed by Martin Landau in an Academy Award-winning performance for Tim Burton's Ed Wood. In other words, since portraying the title vampire in the Universal Studios monster movie classic Dracula, Bela Lugosi's legacy has been cemented into the pantheon of pop culture. And joining us on this edition of Parallax Views to discuss his life and times, from Dracula to Ed Wood's Plan 9 from Outer Space, and even his struggles with drug addiction, is film historian Gary D. Rhodes. By all accounts, Rhodes is the foremost scholar of all things Lugosi. He's written multiple critically acclaimed works on this iconic actor, including Bela Lugosi, Dreams and Nightmares, Ed Wood and the Lost Lugosi Screenplays, and most recently, with the help of previous Parallax Views guest Robert Guffey, Bela Lugosi and the Monogram 9. Now, even if you haven't seen many Bela Lugosi movies, or maybe you're not a fan of horror movies in general, I nonetheless recommend listening to this episode because Lugosi's life is fascinating. And with that being said, why don't we jump right into this previously unpublished conversation with film historian Gary D. Rhodes on the life and times of Bela Lugosi, the man we know as Dracula. Welcome to Parallax Views, Gary Rhodes.
Hi, thanks very much. It's great to be with you.
So I wanted to have you on because you are probably the foremost scholar on Bela Lugosi, who I think we all know, even younger audiences, as the face of Dracula. And if not the face of Dracula, they'll know him from the movie that Tim Burton made in the 90s, Ed Wood, where he was played by Martin Landau. But before we get into the whole Ed Wood connection that younger audiences may be familiar with, tell us a little bit about Bela Lugosi and how he got involved in film. He was rather an accomplished actor even before he did Dracula.
Yes, thanks very much. Yes, he really was. He had been in the legitimate theater from 1902. So by the time he appeared as Dracula the first time, he had already been an experienced actor for a quarter of a century. And that was when he was in his home country of Hungary. He was born in a little town called Lugosi, and that's where he took his name. He was born Bela Blasco, but he took his name from his hometown. And at roughly the age of 20, started his theatrical career. He worked his way through the provinces of Hungary and a bit of what would now be Romania. And by certainly 1910, he was becoming increasingly noticed as an up and coming notable actor in his home country and playing all kinds of roles. For example, he was playing Romeo in Romeo and Juliet. He was playing a lot of the great stage characters, including Shakespeare, including a lot of the major Hungarian playwrights, including at the time were current plays, popular plays of that period. And even Jesus Christ, he appeared as on a number of occasions in a passion play. So his roles in Hungary ranged and across a much broader range than we would now think of him as we think of him for horror. And then by the early years of the teens, he was at the National Theater of Budapest. He left to fight in World War I and returned. And at that time, he made his first film appearances.
I always loved that little tidbit that he actually managed to play Jesus on stage, because he would later go on to play Dracula. It's like he played both God and the devil. But I wanted to ask, too, how did he end up collaborating with the director Todd Browning, who of course directed the Universal classic Dracula, but they also collaborated on a film or two before that and a film after that as well.
Yes, they had a wonderful collaboration, and Todd Browning had really made a name for himself in the 1920s, not only as a major Hollywood director, but a director that was very much, I think the best way to think of him in retrospect would be akin to the way we now think of David Lynch. He was a director that was associated with rather odd, strange, bizarre approaches to filmmaking, but particularly the subject matter of the films. In the 20s, he was most famous for working with Lon Chaney Sr., whom a lot of people do still remember as the Hunchback of Notre Dame and The Phantom of the Opera. At any rate, Browning had realized that Dracula would make a great film. And he realized that. I actually wrote a book called Todd Browning's Dracula about the film he made with Lugosi, but also the road towards it. And one of the, I think, most important discoveries that I came across in writing that book was the fact that Todd Browning was literally trying to make Dracula, the Bram Stoker novel, into a film in 1920.
Wow.
11 years. Yeah, exactly. 11 years before the eventual version he directed came out. But this goes back before there was a stage play starring Lugosi or any other stage actor. This goes back before even Nosferatu, that some listeners will know, the 1922 German version of Dracula. It even goes back before the very first version of Dracula the cinema ever knew, which was the 1921 version made in Hungary. So he was trying to do Dracula for years, and for various reasons it didn't come to pass. The property became popular in the minds of studios again once the stage play became a hit on Broadway. And, of course, Lugosi was the star of that. It's hard to know exactly when, but Browning saw Lugosi in the play, and we suspect it wasn't on Broadway in 1927 and 8 that season. It was probably when Lugosi was appearing in the play in a West Coast version in Los Angeles. He did that in 1928 and again in 29. At any rate, Browning saw him, became fascinated by Lugosi, and cast him in a film in 1929. And this one shows up occasionally on YouTube or TCM. It was a film called The 13th Chair. And it was kind of a mystery play. And Lugosi was rather the opposite of Dracula in that one as well. He was an inspector. There's a murder in the middle of the night. Old dark house, you know, it's one of those kinds of films. And it gave Lugosi the first opportunity to work with Browning in a mystery play, but one where Lugosi was, again, something of, you know, not the hero, but certainly on the side of law and order. And then when Browning had the opportunity to make Dracula in 1930, finally, after a decade of waiting, he ended up casting Lugosi.
Yeah, and it's of course the film that he's most known for. But, you know, what's interesting to me about Bela Lugosi's early career, actually a few of the films he did immediately after Dracula, because, I mean, everyone knows about Bela as Dracula, but he was doing some films that were, rather risque at the time. I'm thinking of White Zombie, Murders in the Rue Morgue, and Edgar G. Ulmer's The Black Cat. They were basically pre-code films, I believe, that really pushed the limits for what could be shown on screen at the time.
You've mentioned a few of my favorite Lugosi films, and they did come in the immediate aftermath of Dracula. When Dracula was released in February 1931, it became a hit beyond what Universal expected or hoped. And it catapulted the Lugosi name onto the lips of the average American, often mispronounced, perhaps. But nevertheless, he became a major star. And the studios, particularly Universal, wanted to put him in other horror films. It was actually the Lugosi version of Dracula, the weeks and months during its release, as it played across the country. That was the first time that the terminology, quote, horror film or, quote, horror movie were ever really used. You know, that was when what we talk of as a horror movie. Now, that was the first time that phrase, that term, gained common currency. And with the popularity of the newly named horror film came the desire to make more of the same. And, of course, the most famous follow-up to Dracula was Frankenstein, in which Lugosi was meant to appear, but he didn't. At any rate, the films you mentioned were the films, the main horror films he made after Dracula, immediately after Dracula. And I think they're tremendous. White Zombie, 1932, set in Haiti. And the character in the title is a woman betrothed to the young male lead, virginal and about to be married, and instead she falls prey to Lugosi, who is a zombie voodoo master, and carves a voodoo doll of her and puts her under his spell and so forth. And what we had there, among other risque moments and plot points, we had the very first zombie feature film. I mean, in today's world, it's hard to get away from zombies, whether The Walking Dead on television or Hollywood feature films. Lugosi, White Zombie, 1932, that was the very first zombie film. That same year, he was in Murders in the Rue Morgue, the first of a few films he did based on the works of Edgar Allan Poe, more than a few, really. And it found him very much different than the Poe story. It found him as a mad doctor who was trying to basically inseminate women with the, they say blood in the film, but it seems to be something more than that. Thematically, he intends to inseminate women with gorillas' blood and fluid to have some kind of monstrous progeny result. So very, again, very risque for the time. And perhaps most of all, as you mentioned, The Black Cat, 1934. Lugosi as a man seeking revenge on a character played by Boris Karloff, a devil worshiper, the head of a satanic cult, which itself was something rarely part of mainstream cinema up until that time, a long, you know, decades before these things in Rosemary's Baby or The Exorcist and that kind of thing. Lugosi ends up literally felling the skin from Karloff's body at the end of that film in silhouette, but nevertheless still pretty grisly fare for 1934. So those were pre-code follow-ups to Dracula, and they're, I think they remain some of the great classics of the horror film.
And of course, you know, one of the interesting aspects of Bela's career is even after he does Dracula, he sort of ends up making career choices that one wouldn't expect. For instance, you mentioned White Zombie. That was an extremely low-budget film. I believe it was one of the first, like, what do they call it, Poverty Row horrors of the era. He had a tendency to appear in films that were lower grade than what one would expect from the big star he had become.
Well, that's very true, and I think there's different possible reasons to account for some of the strange choices he made. He and one of his wives later would blame, you know, poor management, poor advice, and representation. But there were other things happening, too. Though we would think of Lugosi at the peak of his fame in 1931 and 32, he actually went bankrupt in 32. So there became an impetus to make money quickly, as sometimes happens to film actors. The other thing, though, that has been discussed is, you know, he did turn down the part of Frankenstein, and that became a hit film. And one wonders if that was another reason he didn't want to turn down other horror films at that moment, because
the
he
monster?
Had made such a blunder.
The monster Doctor?
Well, that's the interesting thing. There's no doubt that Universal wanted Lugosi to play the monster. When they launched him as Dracula, because there wasn't even a term horror movie yet, what they were perceiving him as more something akin to Lon Chaney Sr. that I mentioned, had died in 1930. And so they were seeking for the talking film era, the sound movies, the 1930s. They were seeking an heir to Lon Chaney more than they were, at least initially, a new horror film star, because there had never really been a horror film star before in Hollywood. So Lon Chaney had been the man of a thousand faces, he was called, famous for all the different types of makeup, unrecognizable sometimes from film to film. And Universal thought, Lugosi can be that new Lon Chaney. He can be the new next man of a thousand faces. And so for him to play the monster, following that logic, made perfect sense. Bury him under horrifying makeup, and he will be in his second horror movie, as they had become called. Lugosi did do one and most likely two different screen tests. Hated the thought of being the monster, not having any dialogue. He thought it was basically any role, a role any extra could almost play. He later did tell at least one friend that he would have been more interested in playing Dr. Frankenstein, but that was not the studio's vision. And so they parted ways on that film, and arguably his career never completely recovered.
He would end up playing both the famed assistant Igor and the monster, I believe, too, in later Universal horrors, though, correct?
That's very true. As the years wore on and his career lessened, his fame lessened, the jobs, the amount of money being paid lessened, he did find himself returning very much so to subsequent sequels. There had even been talk that he would be a character in Bride of Frankenstein. That didn't happen in 1935. He certainly, as you say, became Igor in 1939 in Son of Frankenstein, and he reprised the same role in Ghost of Frankenstein in 1942. The Igor name we, I think, all associate with Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein's hunchbacked assistant, all of that, a very famous kind of iconic horror character. But that character doesn't appear in Mary Shelley's novel from 1818. It doesn't appear in the first film, Frankenstein, the one he turned down in 1931. So Igor was a character that was launched in one of the Frankenstein sequels, and it was played by Lugosi. So he basically would later create that character. And he then finally, in 1943, played the monster, the Frankenstein monster, in a film called Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, the very role he had turned down a decade earlier.
And I believe he even didn't he reprise the role of Dracula in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, or am I wrong about that one?
No, you're absolutely correct. It's an interesting thing. Lugosi, I think your opening was text was absolutely perfect. He remains known, even if not by name, by face, whether it's through Count Chocula, the Count on Sesame Street, the Halloween decorations. The way we picture Dracula is all Lugosi. Not only the way we picture him, but the way we hear him, the accent. It comes from Lugosi's accent, the way he appears, very different, so very different than the way Stoker described him in the novel Dracula in 1897, this more sleek, European, continental, good-looking figure, vampire wearing evening clothes and the cape and so forth. That's all Lugosi. But the interesting thing is, as many times as he played Dracula live, on stage, in vaudeville, and even in nightclub acts, he only played the role twice in feature-length films. So this monumental character we know him for, he only played twice on film, and the second time was in a comedy, as you say, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And he was there with somebody else playing the Frankenstein monster, and Lon Chaney's son, incidentally, playing the Wolfman. So he appeared twice on screen and feature-length films as Dracula.
And I think even his vampire roles are actually pretty sparse. I think he played one role where he was supposed to be a vampire, but he really wasn't, and then he played a vampire in maybe one or two other films.
That's right. You know, and again, that extends what we were talking about even further, and it's an excellent point. No one, I think, is more associated with the role of Dracula or the vampire in general in screen history more than Bela Lugosi. But along with those two times where he actually played Dracula on screen in feature films, he only played a real vampire again in a separate film called Return of the Vampire in 1943. A character in that film who wasn't even named Dracula. There were some other films that always tried to hint that he was maybe a vampire, or that would try to draw links between his role in the new movie and the vampire fame he had. I mean, for example, there's the film Devil Bat, and he's a mad doctor and he creates a monstrous bat. And, it draws a bit of a link in that way to Dracula, because it's a huge vampire bat, but he's still not playing a vampire. So what does all of this mean in the end? It means the most famous screen vampire ever, the most famous Dracula ever, really didn't play those kinds of characters very often on screen.
Well, you know, I really want to get into Bela's now very famous relationship with Ed Wood, but I think a good segue for that... One of the most notorious aspects of Tim Burton's Ed Wood movie was when people would confuse him for Boris Karloff. He would go crazy. Martin Landau's character would start screaming and whatnot. But Bela actually worked with Boris Karloff, Frankenstein's monster himself, a number of times. And I believe their relationship was not actually that bad as would be described in the Ed Wood film.
Yes, no, I having interviewed, so I mean, I've been publishing on Lugosi since 1986, I believe, and now I guess a good half dozen books on the subject I've written and all of that stuff, and so many dozens and dozens of interviews with people now, in most cases, long dead, people who worked with them in those films, knew these people, and in general, no, I think that rivalry between them has been well overblown, including in the Tim Burton film Ed Wood. No, in general, they made several films together and had a cordial, even a distant relationship. But I even the distance of their relationship, you know, that they weren't good pals or whatever, they didn't socialize. But I think one has to augment that by saying Lugosi really didn't socialize with that many people, and more clearly, I should say, with that many people from the film industry. He tended to socialize with the Hungarian community in Los Angeles and the LA area. So the fact that he wasn't necessarily palling around with Karloff doesn't really mean much more than he wasn't palling around with most other of his co-stars either. But as far as hating one another, you know, there's little real evidence of that. I think, you know, late in his life, his last wife, Lugosi's last wife, and one of his close friends of the 1950s told me that late in life he did have a wake in the middle of the night with a nightmare that he was supposed to be meeting Karloff somewhere, you know, a bit shaken in the middle of the night, as anybody could be with a nightmare, I suppose. But as far as actually any real hatred, no, I think that that's all very much overblown.
They made some real real great zingers together, really. I mean, you mentioned The Black Cat, also, you know, The Pit and the Pendulum and The Raven. I really recommend listeners check out some of their collaborations. But I sort of want to fast forward to Lugosi's later years, because that's sort of what Ed Wood covers. Were Lugosi's later years as you know, rough as that film portrays them to be?
Well, I think that's a great question, and it's an interesting feature that while many of the films that you're saying to check out, and I heartily agree, you know, the films that made him famous, all of the Dracula, all of that stuff was really out of the 1930s and to an extent into the 40s, the war era. And that period was what we all concentrated on so long. But there did become, I think, increasingly from the late 70s with the Medved's book on the Golden Turkey Awards that made famous films, Ed Wood films like Plan 9 from Outer Space. Through the 80s, there was a Seinfeld episode, as I recall, about the characters trying to see Plan 9 from Outer Space. And then, of course, culminating with the Tim Burton film in 94, that Ed Wood period, in other words, has become as famous in many ways, or certainly infamous, as the universal glory years of Lugosi. So it's an interesting feature that some of his worst moments, worst films, have kind of been elevated to the status of the best films and the best high points of his career. As far as his own life in that period, it was not as bleak as the Tim Burton film Ed Wood made it appear. He did have some extreme challenges in that period that I'm certainly happy to talk about, but he wasn't as bad off and as lonely as Ed Wood makes it appear. For example, he did marry a 36-year-old woman in 1955, a woman who was, basically half his age, and was with her until the time of his death. He had a large number of friends, both old and new. There was a group of high school students that became fast friends with Lugosi, led by an old pal of mine named Richard Sheffield. We even co-wrote a book together once about Lugosi. So he had a group of young admirers. He had old friends. He had at a given point a young bride. So he wasn't nearly as lonely a figure as Ed Wood makes him appear. All that said, he definitely had some major troubles in the 1950s towards the end of his life.
And what were some of those troubles that he had? I know financial issues, the morphine thing. I don't know if that's overplayed or not.
Yes, well, for me, and this was the book I wrote with Richard Sheffield, his close buddy of the 50s. For me and Richard, I think a lot of it really, I can kind of quickly paint a picture. For one, we could say that there was a kind of a downhill slide from the 30s. Maybe there was a kind of a brief comeback in 39, 40, but in large measure after Dracula, as so often happens with film stars, you know, like it's the law of gravity, you know, after they become famous, their fame lessens over the years. With Lugosi in particular, I think for me, it's obvious where things go wrong. And he made a British tour in the stage play Dracula in 1951. The stage play was a disastrous tour. One person I interviewed who was in the company, the theater company, said that at one performance there were only a couple of people in the audience, literally. And that put a huge strain on Lugosi, his marriage to his then fourth wife, Lillian Arch. They returned to America, and a lot of the business Lugosi had relied on for his career at that latter stage that was there before the British tour had dried up completely. He was doing spook shows. They maybe weren't great, but they were paying well and they were steady. That disappeared after he got back from England for several months there in the United Kingdom. He was doing summer stock revivals. That had been steady work for him in the late 40s. Those disappeared and dried up after he came back from that ill-fated stage play. And then things get even worse. The strain on the marriage means that wife of many years, Lillian Arch, leaves him in 1953 and divorces him. She was also the mother of his son. Then his drinking seems to get worse. And while he had been addicted to morphine and similar substances, prescribed medication, he had become addicted because of back pains, leg pains, some of which dated back to World War I. The period after his wife left him, he began using those again, and even in one interview would later say it was partially for the elation of feeling as much as for the pain usage. This gets to the point that he turns himself in very publicly for drug rehabilitation in 1955.
There was a Senate testimony about his drug addiction.
Absolutely. He became a rather an early and famous figure to come forward in the way that is not at all unknown in the years since, of a famous actor who goes in for drug rehabilitation or so forth. A very early figure to do that and to do it so publicly. All the newspapers covered it. He went into rehabilitation for a few months. And once he comes out of that, he becomes, among other things, a bit of an expert witness on the subject. There is a Senate subcommittee that he testifies before about his drug use. And even Frank Sinatra recognized Lugosi, sending him a wedding gift to that last wedding, in some measure because of his drug rehabilitation. Around that same time, Sinatra was playing a drug addict in a film called The Man with the Golden Arm. So it did bring him some interest, some level of interest, because of the drug use and also, again, the rehabilitation from it.
Well, switching gears to the maybe possibly the lighter side of things, how does Bella end up meeting Ed Wood?
Yes, well, that's a fascinating story. It basically begins, roughly around 1952. As I said, he came back from that ill-fated stage tour of England. The work he was doing in the New England area dried up, the spook shows, all that stuff. So he goes back to the Hollywood area, and there's almost no interest in him for films or television, a tiny bit, but not much. There were, by contrast, a few younger people who were interested in working with him, but they were just trying to get their careers going. And a couple of them were fast friends at that time named Alex Gordon and Ed Wood. And they were trying to make a film that they were then calling The Atomic Monster. It would later be shot by Ed Wood and called Bride of the Monster. But at any rate, so there's a couple of young producers. One of them happens to be Ed Wood, who want to work with him. Wood has an extreme difficulty in getting films off the ground, though. And when he finally has a chance to make a feature in 1953 and hires Lugosi, it is a film about, it's an exploitation movie. It's a film about transvestitism, and it's called Glenn or Glenda. So after initially, in other words, approaching Lugosi about a mad scientist role of the type Lugosi had played so many times on screen, Lugosi ends up becoming a kind of an omniscient style narrator in this exploitation film that's somewhat based on transvestites. Wood himself was a transvestite, but also sex change operations, and in particular, Christine Jorgensen. So that becomes the first time they work together on screen. And from that point onward, we can debate how close of friends they were. There's definitely different views on that subject. I interviewed a lot of the people that, worked with both of them in those films, but they end up making, well, we can debate this also, but they end up making basically three films together.
And also, I think Bella even wrote a foreword for one of Ed Wood's books, Your Career in Hollywood, right?
Absolutely. This goes, I think, back to the question of how close of friends they were or not. I know that one person who knew them both believed it was a bit of a, certainly not friendly, but a bit of a, we need each other, Lugosi desperate for work, Wood desperate to get films off the ground, and Lugosi still did have a bit of name value. So other people would say that they were much closer. At any rate, there's no doubt that they were trying to help one another. And so Lugosi wrote the foreword to an Ed Wood book. Ed Wood was trying to contact comic book publishers and get them to publish a Lugosi comic, something like Tales from the Crypt, where Lugosi would have been this would have been artwork, of course, but Lugosi would have been kind of the host of the different stories. Ed Wood was trying to get a Lugosi horror radio show off the ground. Wood was trying to get various types of work for Lugosi, and even kind of became part of other things that were percolating for Lugosi at that time. For example, Wood was certainly helpful, even if in a small way, to Lugosi when Lugosi did appear in a Las Vegas nightclub act in 1954. So there was a lot of connection between the two, helping one another, even though on screen it materialized in only three films. Wood certainly wrote other films for Lugosi, and scripts for some of them survive. He wrote a Western called The Ghoul Goes West, which was going to co-star Gene Autry, the old singing cowboy, with Lugosi. There was another film called The Vampire's Tomb, one of those, to go back to our earlier conversation, another attempt to connect Lugosi back to vampirism and by proxy Dracula, even if unnamed in the script. These scripts survive, but they survive only in the form of pages. So as much as they were trying to do for one another, it only results in three films.
So unlike the film, it's not necessarily that they were completely chummy with each other, but it also, it sounds like Ed Wood wasn't merely just out to exploit Bella's fame either.
No, I don't believe that, because there were many cases where he helped Lugosi beyond obvious career potential for Wood. I think that there's also the fact that, that Wood and a couple of Wood's cronies and actors were pally with Lugosi. Lugosi went to a Christmas party. One of them hosted. Certainly a couple of them, including Wood, were key figures at Lugosi's last wedding in 1955. So it is how close they were is debatable, but there's no doubt that there was somewhat of a friendship there, because there were those kinds of events celebrations together and so forth, and it extended, like I say, it extended beyond Wood just to a couple of the Tor Johnson, maybe the most famous of them, who appeared in some of Wood's horror movies and some other horror movies, Paul Marco, another, and these people were, like I say, they were feted by Lugosi at his final wedding even. So there was a kinship there. How close, who knows, but there was a kinship there.
Well, I think it brings us to one of my real favorite collaborations next to Plan 9, I guess, that they did was Bride of the Monster. Could you tell us a little bit about Bride of the Monster? It's pretty infamous now because of Tim Burton's Ed Wood.
Yes, yes. Well, this was the kind of film that Wood had originally wanted to make with Lugosi. You know, one that would harken back to his earlier days of the 30s and 40s, harken back to the kinds of roles that Lugosi curiously did play many more times than vampires on screen, and that was the mad scientist. More than vampires, he played mad scientists one after the other. And Bride of the Monster was that chance. In fact, Bride of the Monster had its origins in that 1952 script I mentioned, The Atomic Monster. It was just simply a change of title, but that was finally what Wood had first wanted to make with Lugosi came to pass. It was shot slowly over a period of time in the mid-50s. It gained a legitimate release across the United States, even though it was extremely low budget. And it featured, on the one hand, a few decent actors, or certainly notables, like Tor Johnson, along with Lugosi. It was his last major speaking role. And yet, at the same time, we're talking about, you mentioned the phrase Poverty Row earlier. Poverty Row had certainly been used to describe some of the low-budget studios and B-movies of the 30s and 40s. If that's what they were, I mean, some people have less kindly called Bride of the Monster a Z-grade picture rather than B, because it was so much lower budget than anything he had made before, except for arguably Glenn or Glenda. At any rate, so Bride of the Monster, there's various famous stories associated with it. The octopus prop that wasn't operating properly, so it had to be thrashed about to make it look like its tentacles were moving, even though the prop wasn't working. It was cheap props all the way around, and this kind of wonderfully strange Ed Wood style, really, a dialogue that was often not only poorly written and inept, but unintentionally funny. This kind of weird world that Ed Wood became known for, right? Having the reputation, at least for some years, as the worst film director ever, making the worst movies ever made.
I actually want to comment on that, because I've always had sort of a bone to pick about that ever since, the Wood craze started with, Michael Medved with the Golden Turkey Award.
Yes.
It's weird because, like, as bad as a director as Ed Wood may have been, I respect his there's like an earnestness to his films. I know his writing style has influenced a whole genre called the new sincerity in literature now. And also, I always loved the Ed Wood, especially with Bride of the Monster and Plan 9 from Outer Space. He was doing something completely different genre-wise. He was melding 50s sci-fi with the gothic horror of the 1930s. I think a lot of people miss that aspect of those films.
Excuse me. Well, yeah, I think absolutely so. I enjoy Bride of the Monster myself a great deal. I mean, in some ways, it's sad to see Lugosi so old, frail, and in such a cheap film. And I can understand that view that some audience members have. For me, there's a lot of joy to these pictures because they are earnest. I think that's a great word for them. I mean, for example, I love Bride of the Monster so much, I did an entire book on that, just that one film. So there is a kind of a sincerity to them. I mean, there's a kind of an autobiographical sincerity to Glenn or Glenda. There's certainly a sincerity about Bride of the Monster and trying to make the kind of mad scientist film that Wood as a child grew up loving. And then, of course, we get to Plan 9 from Outer Space, and it's interesting we're talking about it. I screened it to a university class just a week ago, talking about the subject of unintentional film comedy, because a lot of people love it, and I think it's a lot of people love it because of the reasons you mentioned. it does tend to bring together elements of the 30s Universal horror films and the 50s sci-fi. Its original title makes that, I think, maybe most clear. It was originally called Grave Robbers from Outer Space. But there's also a genuine fun quality to the films, and I think the students I showed it to at the University of Central Florida last week, this is where I'm a professor of film, loved it and enjoyed it, and I think that there's a different kind of enjoyment here. It's rather than a kind of a making fun of the film, a lot of us enjoy these and enjoy with the film. You know, or laugh even with the film, because there is that sincerity, that great sincerity there, and this great shared quality of the Wood movies, even the ones without Lugosi, where we see some.
He even made a sequel to like Bride of the Monster and Plan 9, sort of pseudo sequel called Night of the Ghouls.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely, and some of the same characters and turn up in it, and some of the same actors, and I think that's another. Interesting feature that if we think of a great filmmaker as having a consistent style over a body of works, I mean, we would tend to call this in the film industry or film studies the auteur, right? The great director who has a repetitive style that stamps individuality on his films such that we can recognize them one after the other. And there are those qualities to Wood's films. Some people may not be willing to give him that, but they're there, and they're there in part because of a shared screenwriting style, a shared directing style, but also even a shared cast of characters. Some of these same actors, some of the many that I once interviewed about Lugosi and Wood, some of the same actors reappearing, including playing sometimes the same characters as well. Kelton the cop was a character that turns up in three of these films, and Kelton the cop was played by Paul Marco, who was a bit of a fixture in Hollywood at the time. He was one of the people that was at the Lugosi wedding I mentioned. Paul Marco was a good friend of mine from the 1980s, and of all things, the last interview he ever gave was for a book of mine, and within a short few hours after the interview, he passed away, but he had a degree of fame all those many years after the fact for having played Kelton the cop. So collectively, what does this mean to me? It does mean that there's a kind of a shared, when I say the weird world of Ed Wood, I think that's a way of putting this kind of individual style in so many respects that is recurrent in film after film that we see from Ed Wood, including, as you say, films like Night of the Ghouls that didn't star Lugosi, you know, and to an extent we can even debate whether the Lugosi was in Plan 9 from Outer Space, you know, I mean, the footage of him in it was not necessarily shot for that film, you know, there's debate about that as well, but it was repurposed stock footage that Wood had, in essence, you know.
Well, I want to stick on Plan 9 for a second, but, you know, the first thing that always stuck out to me about Plan 9, there's so much ineptness in it, but at the same time, and you see this in the Tim Burton film, there's shots in that movie that I think are actually very iconic, and almost in a way I would even go as far as to say well done. The famous shot of Vampyra, you know, in the background lurking.
Yeah.
There's actually moments of brilliance.
Stunning. I think I absolutely agree with you. And when I was screening the film to these students just last week, they commented on that. And I always enjoy refreshing my memory about not only those iconic shots of Vampyra, but her lack of dialogue, her blocking coming towards the camera from the trees. I think the other iconic shot is Tor Johnson emerging from his grave as a kind of a zombie, a reanimated corpse, and underlit beautifully. I mean, Wood sometimes was working with, you know, some very talented, even if elder craftsmen, working with some very talented people, including cinematographers that helped make those kinds of images happen. I think there's other interesting things that can be said about Plan 9. I mean, this notion of a kind of a universal Holocaust that if the humans gain control now that they have nuclear power, if they gain control of this fictitious solar benite, I believe is the phrase that would bring, you know, catastrophe to the whole universe. You know, this is not unlike, you know, at least thematically, the kinds of stories we see happening in, say, Dr. Strangelove in 1964, you know, the fears of complete annihilation that were coming out of the Cold War and the arms race and fears of nuclear power. I mean, there are some interesting themes, in other words, in the Wood films, just as there's some wonderful images and moments mixed in with somewhat shoddy special effects and some writing that would be not the norm of Hollywood at the period, we could certainly say.
And I'm just curious, this last note on Plan 9, I guess. So is the story that we see in Tim Burton's Ed Wood true? They got a chiropractor to sort of replace Lugosi? Or what is the real story behind that?
Yes, well, that is absolutely true. Because Wood basically fashioned the Lugosi character in the film, who's credited as a ghoul man, named a ghoul man, he had that little bit of footage of Lugosi. It's difficult to say with certainty whether he already had the idea for Plan 9 when he shot that footage of Lugosi in 1956, or, as some argue, it was maybe even shot for a different project and just planted into Plan 9 when it happened. After all, the film was basically produced and released after Lugosi's death. Lugosi died in 56. Plan 9, often miscredited as being released in 1959. It was actually in general release in 58. But at any rate, well, after Lugosi's death, which is kind of an interesting feature that Lugosi was starring in a film that he may have not even known about a couple of years after he died, and his name is again on theater marquees, at least in some theaters. But there was just that little bit of footage of Lugosi, and a little bit of it shows him wearing a vampire cape, yet another kind of one of those allusions to Dracula without him being Dracula or a vampire. At any rate, how do we flesh that role out? That was the thought. And so Wood had the idea that, well, if I just have a stand-in, a double, basically, in some other scenes with the cape up over his face, nobody will know that that's not Lugosi. And it was, because it was just the cape over the face and the film was so cheaply made, he did get a chiropractor to do, Dr. Tom Mason, to do that role. Watching the film, again, I refer to showing it to some wonderful students here last week, they quickly saw what I think we all see, and that is, despite the effort to appear like Lugosi, it's obviously not Lugosi. And the shots of Lugosi further stand out because of they're obviously of a different lower quality of film, you know, than the rest of the movie as well.
And, you know, I want to backtrack just a bit, because that was Bela's posthumous movie. But there's one more movie that came out, I believe, in 56, that, not directed by Ed Wood, but does feature both Bela Lugosi and Ed Wood's resident hulking monster, Tor Johnson. And I'm talking about the movie The Black Sleep. If you could just briefly cover that one for my listeners, because I think it's an odd film.
Yes, that's a wonderfully odd film. And it shares a quality of some of the earlier Universal films, even by the time of The Black Cat and some of those films we were talking about, The Raven and so on. The idea became, after the initial horror films were made, how do we heighten the horror? How do we give the audience even still something they haven't seen before? Let's put more than one famous horror actor into the same film. And so we start seeing that a lot in the Universal horror films from the mid-30s onward. And The Black Sleep in 1956, which was released through United Artists, tried to do that. Here was Basil Rathbone, once famous for some of his horror films, as well as for playing Sherlock Holmes, of course. We have Lon Chaney Jr., who had co-starred with Lugosi, even in a couple of the films we've mentioned, like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. We have Tor Johnson, as you say, whose minor fame extended a little beyond the world of Ed Wood as far as the cinema goes. He was also a TV wrestler at one point. And so we have this collection of characters and Lugosi.
You forgot one actor. You forgot John Carradine, the great John Carradine.
Oh, yes.
My favorite.
The great John Carradine, who had, I think, one of the two or three, after Orson Welles, one of the two or three best voices of the 20th century, and who had done some work with Lugosi at Monogram, and they'd even appeared on the pilot of a radio show together called Mystery House. So this cast of characters is there together. There's even yet others we could name. But Lugosi becomes part of that group, even though he was rather frail and old near the end of his life. He couldn't see as well anymore. He was still drinking heavily. He was cast, obviously, because of his horror film fame. Some of his old movies were being shown regularly on television by then, so he wasn't making any money from it, but it certainly kept him a little bit in the public eye. And again, the fame from the drug rehabilitation, or I should say at least, you know, the fame, the press, you know, he received from that, all led to an old producer that I knew well named Howard W. Koch. He for a while was in charge of Paramount Pictures, but that was later. At that point, he was producing the film. They cast Lugosi as part of that group. They did not give him lines of dialogue because he was not well, but it was a chance to appear in one last film, a B movie, but certainly far beyond the budget and world of Ed Wood. And it became his last movie, really, especially when we consider that he may have not ever even heard the words Plan 9 from Outer Space. It became his last real movie that he knew about, that he intentionally appeared in. And it got some decent press when it was released. I mean, Vampyra appeared at some of the premiere screenings. Lugosi went. Television cameras were there. I think one of the best things about that film, it's a strange film. It's well worth seeing. There's a great Blu-ray restoration of it out now for anybody who wants to take a peek at it. But I think one of the great things about that film is the story of its release, of its premiere night, because it was one last major hurrah for Lugosi before his death, a bit of a glimmer, you see, of the old fame he once had.
And I know we have to wrap up here in a minute, but I wanted to ask you on you know, sort of an ending note. You have a book coming up with another alumni of the Parallax Views guest list, Robert Guffey. I believe it's Bela Lugosi and the Monogram 9. What is that book about?
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you very much. Yes, that book should be out in time for Christmas of this year. And Robert Guffey is a great colleague and friend, and we co-authored it together. And there's a period really between the two poles of Lugosi's Hollywood career that we talked about. We spoke a lot about the Universal period, the glory days when he was Dracula and the Black Cat and all of those. And then, as I said, his career kind of went on a downward slide, and then he ends up in those Ed Wood pictures in the 50s. What happened in the 40s, the kind of between, one of the things that happened was that he landed at a Poverty Row studio, a B-movie studio called Monogram. And they made a lot of different films ranging from comedies to a lot of Westerns to a lot of cheap horror films, B-horror movies, particularly for the World War II period. And Lugosi, as he began playing more and more supporting parts at the major studios, in the 40s, he was given starring roles at Monogram, and he appeared in a total of 9 Monogram films, and they have become known as the Monogram 9. And they have a great charm of their own, again, for reasons not entirely unlike we were describing about Ed Wood. They're B-movies. They have all kinds of limitations, but there's wonderful moments in them. The first of them, Invisible Ghost, was directed by Joseph H. Lewis, who went on to make such films as Gun Crazy, one of the best film noir crime movies ever made. So there's flashes of brilliance in them, and yet there's also all these kind of budgetary limitations. There's wonderful casts. He appears in them with people like John Carradine, you were mentioning, with George Zucco, who another actor kind of associated with horror films in the 30s and 40s. And so they're really quite delightful, I think. These are normally films, very brief running time, 60 minutes, 65 minutes. And with very crazy themes, perhaps not as crazy as The World of Ed Wood, but moving in that direction. Wonderful, delightful movies like The Ape Man, Voodoo Man, Black Dragons, Return of the Ape Man, no less, Ghosts on the Loose, Spooks Run Wild. You know, these titles alone are wonderful. And so that classic, many of us believe classic despite their low budgets, that classic nine films is what Robert and I's forthcoming book is about.
So I have to ask, do you solve the mystery of the movie Return of the Ape Man, which credits George Zucco, even though he's not in any scenes in the movie?
Yes, absolutely. He was meant to play the Ape Man. Somebody else is under the makeup, as it turned out. But Zucco, he's forgotten now, except for the most stalwart film buffs and horror fans. But his name resonated to an extent in the 40s and with the crowds flocking to some of these horror films. So his name appeared, even despite not really being in the film, just to help, I suppose, motivate crowds in to see them. Because that particular film you're asking about, Zucco's not in it, but he gets credited, and then there is John Carradine again and Lugosi, and so it's part of that, I think, movement that again tried to say, oh, if one horror star is great, let's give them two or three in the same film, no less.
And I always tell my listeners I want to end on a positive note, and maybe a little bit of a funny note in this one, so I want to ask, what do you think Lugosi's legacy is? Do you think people will continue to remember him? And also, was the Ed Wood movie exaggerating a bit with regards to Bela Lugosi's supposed crush on Vampyra?
Well, I think at parts of his life, and we know this with all kinds of research dating back to, say, 1908 to 1910 is a period I and a colleague have spent a lot of time. Bill Kaffenberger is his name. We've spent a lot of time looking at some of those periods, and he was quite the ladies' man at times in his life. But I think Ed Wood largely exaggerates for the sake of being a fun dramatic, fun film for dramatic purposes as well. It exaggerates a lot of those things. But Lugosi certainly had an eye for the ladies, and very definitely had periods of his life where he was a ladies' man. As far as his legacy, I think despite the fame of the Ed Wood movies and the joy a lot of us really do, certainly myself, associate with them, despite a lot of these wonderful films that we've talked about from the Monogram days to, say, White Zombie or The Black Cat, The Raven, those films, I think his real legacy is and will always be Dracula. He completely changed the way Dracula looked and was understood into a much more handsome, sexualized figure, into a much more, in some ways, inviting figure, rather than the more grotesque image of Stoker's Dracula. Here's somebody that's inviting that is maybe perhaps the point of being a vampire, to enable you to lure victims. And, of course, that classic Lugosi voice. What does all of this mean for me? I think the quickest way to encapsulate it would be that I think during his lifetime, especially on stage, live appearances, TV shows, photo ops, during his lifetime, Lugosi dressed as Dracula over and over and over again. Since Lugosi's death, Dracula has continued to dress like Lugosi. The way when people picture Dracula, even if they've never watched the original 1931 film, even if they don't know the name Bela Lugosi, when people picture Dracula now, they're picturing Lugosi or something very similar to what he inaugurated in the cinema back in 1931.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you again for coming on Parallax Views, Gary Rhodes, to celebrate the life and times of Bela Lugosi and also his relationship with Ed Wood.
Thank you so very much. It's been wonderful to join you.
Well, that does it for this bonus edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with film historian Gary D. Rhodes on the life and times of Dracula himself, Bela Lugosi. Be sure to check out Gary's most recent book, Bela Lugosi and the Monogram 9, co-authored with previous Parallax Views guest Robert Guffey. I think it would make a great stocking stuffer now that the holiday season is upon us. Anyways, I hope this was a nice little Halloween treat for my listeners out there. Have a fun time on October 31st and be safe on this holiday where the freaks and the geeks of the world finally have their day. As always, you can drop me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmill.com. Also, you can support me on Patreon, where I release the Parallax Views current events program the week that was. Your support is very much appreciated. And with that being said, happy Halloween, folks!